watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. We're told from our earliest years that we live in a free country. What we're not told is that this freedom is available only on a sliding scale. If you don't have money in America, you experience tyranny and brutality from every direction, and you will sooner or later wind up in jail. From cradle to grave, you are never home free. You've either got a landlord to pay, a mortgage to pay, or taxes to pay. Failure to pay any of the above will put you in the street, where you will be arrested for sleeping in your car if you have one, or have your car taken away because you can't buy insurance or pay the ticket you got for sleeping in the car. You can't sleep in a public park because it's public, and you can't sleep on private property because it's private. In fact, you can't even pee anywhere because restrooms are for paying customers only. There are even laws in many places that make it illegal not to have money in your pocket. It's called vagrancy. The only inalienable right you have as an American is the freedom to become a convict. Homelessness makes this visible, which is why homeless people are so persecuted, at least so I think. What does all this say about our values as a society? How are these values formed and perpetuated? For what purpose? Why do people accept a freedom that can only be purchased with dollars? These are the issues we'll explore this week on the program from several different angles. We'll begin as Mike McCormick interviews the author of Free Market Missionaries.
Sharon Beter is a visiting professor in the School of Social Sciences, Media and Communication at the University of Wollongong in New South Wales, Australia. She is the author of numerous articles and 9 books, including Toxic Fish and Sewer Surfing, The Nature of Sustainable Development, Global Spin, The Corporate Assault on Environmentalism, Power Play, The Fight for Control of the World's Electricity, Suiting Themselves, How Corporations Drive the Corporate Agenda, and she is here to talk about her new book, Free Market Missionaries, The Corporate Manipulation of Community Values. Let's begin, and if you could tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Free Market Missionaries?
Well, the book actually started off as a broader book about how corporations are pushing markets as solutions for everything, public services, environmental problems, etc. And it was such a broad topic that it ended up being 3 books, well, actually 4 books if you include the electricity book, because I was actually had started on this book looking at free markets and the history of corporate propaganda when I found that the utility companies were very active in the whole issue. And at the same time, which is a few years ago now, there was a Californian electricity crisis and Enron was going bust, and I realised that all these things were linked. And so I took time out to write my book about electricity, and then I got back to this book, and then this book turned out to be still too big because there was the issue of corporate political mobilisation as well as manipulating community values. So that was 2 books, and then the application of market solutions to environmental issues became a 3rd book called Environmental Principles and Policies. So these books have been sort of self-multiplying.
So talk a bit about the whole concept behind free market PR. Where and when did that come about?
Well, corporate PR has developed throughout the 20th century, and it began, I guess, early in the 20th century when people started getting a bit concerned about the way that big corporations were merging and becoming larger. And the public was generally suspicious of so much power being in the hands of a few businesses. And so the first PR efforts were generally by individual companies who were trying to portray themselves as being caring corporations and as performing public services. And as I say, this included the utility companies. But over time, the corporate public relations went from individual firms to trade associations, and then more recently business coalitions have been trying to not only portray individual companies as caring, but to manage the image and reputation of business as a whole and to manipulate public opinion so that the community accepts business values as core American values. And this has been happening in not just in the US, but it's been copied in other countries, for example, in Australia.
And what methods do these entities use towards changing our opinions?
Well, you'd be amazed at the efforts. When I wrote an earlier book, Global Spin, about the corporate assault on environmentalism, I discovered things like front groups and AstroTurf and all the strategies that corporations use for not just extending their voice to seem like the corporate voice is coming from other voices, but deceiving people into thinking that it's much more widespread than it is. But when I started on these books, I discovered that those methods go right back to much earlier in the 20th century. So every method that you can think of, obviously the media, but also getting material into schools is a big issue, and training teachers and having workshops and conferences for teachers to make sure that people get these messages really young before they're, you know, able to be too critical of them. They've made films, bought radio stations, bought media, of course, produced television shows, sent speakers around to all the different Rotary clubs and business clubs and community clubs and churches, funded university centres and scholarships and student publications. And, of course, there was that whole effort in the 1970s when a whole new bunch of organisations were formed for the same purpose of promoting the free market message, starting with think tanks, pressure groups, special interest foundations, litigation centres, publishing and TV production houses, political consultancies, media attack operations. What we're talking about is billions of dollars being poured into this campaign or this propaganda onslaught to persuade the American people that the business way is the only way and that business interests are everyone's interests and that business shouldn't be overregulated.
So it really was in the 70s when they really started to push the free market idea?
No, the free market idea actually dates back to the 1930s. This was a time when, during the Depression, when people started being disillusioned about business's ability to provide employment, and the government was stepping in with the New Deal and intervening in the economy, and these were things that the business world, especially, you know, the leaders of some of these big corporations, didn't like. And so the first sort of massive coordinated campaign was in the 1930s, coordinated by NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers, but with lots of business supporting this campaign to sell free enterprise and to get people back on side with free enterprise and to oppose the New Deal.
Yeah, a National Association of Manufacturers isn't something that's a household term here in the U.S.,
oh, right.
But people should,
it should be.
People should know it because they're very influential and powerful.
That's right. And I mean, it goes right back to, as far as I know, 1913 when they were a government committee found them guilty of, perverting democracy, you know, undermining democracy anyway, through their propaganda efforts. And they're still involved in many efforts today. For example, they're one of the forces behind the privatisation of Social Security, which on the face of it has been sold as something that is necessary because the government's not going to have enough money in 40 years to provide Social Security for everyone. But in fact is again part of this whole ideological push for free markets, because what they've figured is that people who own shares tend to subscribe to free market values much more, tend to vote Republican, and tend to favour pro-business policies because they want to see their share values going up. And what private social security does is it puts people's money into the share market, as 401k plans do as well. And so people then are concerned about the value of shares and the share market going up. And so it sort of aligns their values much more towards business values. So it's all part of, it's a much more subtle arm to this whole campaign of selling free enterprise. I'm not opposed to free enterprise, I should say, but as a one and only solution that shouldn't be regulated.
Well, the free market proponents, if you listen to them, which it's hard not to, say that the whole concept of the market is this self-regulating, benign entity that, you know, doesn't really discriminate. What's the truth to that?
Well, the interesting thing is that the free market story that is sold in schools and in advertisements and in the propaganda is a very naive version of, I guess, neoclassical economics. It's a very naive version of how things work, of the economic system. And obviously, corporate leaders themselves don't believe in this same message. So, for example, you know, the free market story emphasises competition as one of the key aspects of markets, yet big corporations do their utmost to avoid competition by mergers and by buying up competition and getting as close to a monopoly position as they can. So you have this story that's been sold that the markets provide choice and competition and efficiency, and therefore you get the lowest prices and quality, and that markets are democratic and fair and are the best means of providing all goods and services, and that includes essential services like electricity and water, when the truth is that whilst markets are good for a lot of commodified goods, like white goods, for example, they're not good for providing other things such as essential services that need to be planned and need to have equitable access for everyone. And the problem is that the free market story doesn't have these nuances. It doesn't talk about monopolies. It doesn't talk about the need for regulation. It doesn't, in fact, it opposes regulation as interfering and distorting the market. So the free market story says that if everyone follows their self-interest, then the public interest will be served, and the government doesn't have to step in and make sure that the public interest is served. And it says that what's good for business is good for society, and that business freedom equals personal freedom, equals economic freedom, equals personal freedom, individual freedom, and therefore equals political freedom. So you've got this equation that you've got to have freedom for business if you're going to have political freedom, which doesn't necessarily follow. In fact, you know, some of the power that business is getting now is interfering with political freedom and undermining democracy.
And the very corporations themselves that are driving this, it appears that it's pretty tough to find democratic process within the corporations themselves.
Yes, but again, this whole idea of shareholder democracy is part of this PR push to portray companies as being accountable because they're accountable to their shareholders. And if everybody owns shares, then they have a say, everybody has a say in the running of corporations, which is another way that this simplistic story doesn't reflect reality at all, because individual small shareholders have very, very little power and very little say in the running of corporations. And generally the institutional shareholders have much more power. And even then, shareholders often have limited power apart from appointing the CEO. And often the CEO appoints members of the board and has a certain influence with members of the board. So the power of shareholders is much more limited than is put forward by the free market story.
The subtitle of your book, The Corporate Manipulation of Community Values, can you talk about, give us some examples of corporations manipulating community values?
Well, of course, they do it in concert these days. So it's not individual corporations, but it's coalitions. But just take this issue of regulation. In 1975, 22% of people thought, of the people in the US surveyed, thought that there was too much regulation. Only 22%. There was a massive campaign led by the Advertising Council starting in 1976. It was a multi-million dollar campaign over several years, supported by most of the major US corporations, that was, on the face of it, was to help people understand the American economic system. At the end of this campaign, in 1980, the number of people who thought there was too much regulation had gone from 22% to 60%, which has all sorts of implications, because in the 1970s, of course, you had the rise of the environmental movement, you had the rise of the consumer movement, and all the associated regulation that was going along with that. And all this started to be pushed back in the 1980s as a result of this change in public opinion and also the corporate lobbying and influence behind the scenes, so that sorts of regulations that we should have in place now, for example, to protect the environment, to prevent global warming, the fuel efficiency standards, all these sorts of things are not in place. And so we could have been dealing with global warming years ago, and countries like the US and Australia as well, of course, are very much behind in doing anything about greenhouse gas emissions. And part of this is this whole change in community opinion about regulation.
And that goes back to some of the examples you were citing earlier about the different ways in which these associations, these entities, get their ideas across, going all the way to the schools and influencing teachers and school books. Can you talk about that?
Okay, well, what happened in the 1976 campaign, the Ad Council produced these various booklets, and one of them was called America's Economic System. And they did things like they illustrated these booklets with Charlie Brown cartoons, so that they were very accessible to adults and children alike. These booklets were advertised for free because this is part of the deal with the Advertising Council, which, you know, covers all the advertising industry, is that they get the member and contributing organisations provide media time for free. So they got these booklets were advertised for free on over 400 television stations, over 1,000 radio stations, over 3,000 newspapers. They were advertised in 400 magazines. They also advertised on transit cards, counter cards, in the flyers that people got with their bank statements and their utility bills. They were distributed free to over 1,300 schools, 1,800 workplaces. They were reprinted in 100 newspapers and magazines. So you can see this massive distribution of their little booklet, which said that the economic system gives everyone a say in what's produced, regulation distorts the market, how important it is for everyone to work hard to increase the productivity of the country and make it wealthy, and that the economic system delivers a high standard of living and so therefore it shouldn't be interfered with. In terms of schools, there were millions of packages of materials, not just produced by the Ad Council, but by individual companies and trade associations and business coalitions, all sent to schools. They sent schools films to show. They helped to develop curricula. They had speech and essay competitions for children. They offered teachers summer employment to show them how the business system worked. They educated teachers, etc., etc. And the other thing about schools is the whole push for economic education, which I haven't mentioned, which started way back after the Second World War, but is still going now. And the idea was that part of the 1970s campaign was they introduced this idea of economic illiteracy and an economic quotient, EQ, as opposed to IQ. And EQ was that how much people knew about the economy. And, of course, knowing about the economy meant knowing the business version of how the economy works. So a lot of the push for economic education in schools was about teaching children this market story that I mentioned before, this naive version of the market. And I just give you an example of a survey that was done recently to show that people are economically naive. This is one of the questions. This is a survey that the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis did to survey economic literacy. And the question was, what would happen to employment if the government mandated a minimum wage above what employers currently pay? And the choice of answers was employment would go up, employment would go down, employment would stay the same. And the correct answer, if you were economically literate, is employment would go down. So there, if you don't think that a government-mandated minimum wage would cause employment to go down, then you're economically illiterate and you need to be educated. And they found, of course, that people who were economically literate supported business and supported business values. And so what we have now is, in schools, economic education was, during the 1980s, was required in 27 states, and it's probably more now. And there's been these economic education standards put together by the National Council for Economic Education, and these standards tell schools what students should know each year. They're like literacy standards or numeracy standards, but they're economic standards. But the difference is that these economic standards are very ideologically based. You know, they're political statements that students have to learn at school.
So this is clearly a very coordinated campaign.
That's right.
It sounds like as time goes on, it gets more and more coordinated, more top-down.
That's right. Well, I guess it's always been top-down, but what's happening is that there's broader business coalitions involved. So, you know, when PR started in the early days, it was very much individual firms or trade associations. For example, the association representing the electricity industries. But these days you have organisations where most of the Fortune 500 companies are members, and not just some of their executives, but their CEOs are active in these organisations. So it's right at the top of the companies as well.
And there's clearly no oversight in terms of this information that's coming across. Are there any bodies that regulate that?
Well, unfortunately, what happens is that this material goes into schools without oversight because it's not coming through the normal channels, and it's for free, and it's glossy, it's professionally put together. And the other thing that's happening, which is what I'm writing my book about now, is with schools being defunded, partly because of unwillingness of wealthy people and corporations to pay taxes, that schools don't have enough money to actually buy decent materials themselves, so that they grab at these free materials because they don't have anything else, they don't have any choice. And to understand, I mean, some teachers obviously can tell the biases and can overcome, you know, can compensate for the biases in the material, you know, themselves, but other teachers aren't economists or have been brought up and trained with this, you know, through the corporate training and propaganda, you know, themselves, and they accept what the materials are correct, and they go on to teach the same free market story.
And what do you see as where the arc is heading on this current PR push?
Well, I think there must eventually be a disconnect between the story that this is good for us and the reality of people's lives. I'm actually surprised it hasn't happened yet, that people can see, and I think some people can, obviously, can see that what the free market story, what they're being told about their interests being aligned with business interests, is not the case at all. That for most people, whilst corporate CEO wages have been soaring, corporate profits have been soaring, worker wages have been declining, and that the real incomes of the lower income levels have remained at best static over the last 10 or 20 years. So you have this complete concentration of wealth going to corporations and to the people who have the big shareholdings, you know, the wealthy people, the wealthy families. And there's been quite a lot of publicity about CEO pay, for example, and a bit of publicity about corporate profits too. I mean, for example, the most recent one I read was Exxon's profit of $52 billion. I mean, it reaches the realms of the ridiculous, you know, considering, you know, people's everyday pay.
And we've also seen here of late different corporations, including Microsoft, that one of the mechanisms they use for pushing their values is to get people to, for instance, write letters to the editor, things like that, supporting the different corporations and their ideas.
Yes, well, and that's not actually a new method. For many years now, corporations have not just got people to write letters, but they've paid people to write columns. They've paid scientists to put their name to papers that they've put together promoting corporate research that shows that their products are safe, for example. This method, I guess, of using third parties to promote the corporate message has been going on a long time. I mean, the whole thing about AstroTurf, which got its name much more recently, is the idea of giving the impression to politicians particularly that there is some grassroots push to oppose legislation or to get pro-business legislation introduced. And I should say, you know, when corporations oppose legislation, then it's not that they're against regulation, they're just against anti-business regulation. They're happy enough to have regulations that protect investments, for example. So this AstroTurf promotes the impression that there's widespread support for what the corporations want to happen through things like letter-writing campaigns, generating phone calls by what they do is they ring up a lot of people. I describe this in my book, Global Spin. They ring up people. They have banks of callers ringing up people and saying, this proposed legislation will cause these problems. Do you think that it should be opposed? And if the person this is the first they've heard about it, they say, oh, yes, it doesn't sound very good. Before they have a chance to think about it or get any alternative information, they're patched through to the office of the congressman, and they find themselves there talking to the congressman's office saying, this legislation doesn't sound very good, I'm concerned about these things. And the congressman or the congresswoman gets all these phone calls, and they think, oh, there must be this massive grassroots or generated opposition to this legislation, when actually it's all been orchestrated by the public relations firm.
So in your book, Free Market Missionaries, you say that the center of all this, these techniques, is really happening here in the U.S. And do you see it being exported to other countries?
Yes, definitely exported. Yes, a lot of these techniques that I've described and also these huge propaganda campaigns first began in the United States, but they've spread. They've spread partly because these corporations are obviously transnational corporations, and what works in the US they'll then use in other countries where they operate, but also because businesses in other countries see what US corporations have achieved and they want to follow the same lead. So, for example, the 1970s Ad Council campaign in the US was copied in Australia coordinated by an organisation called Enterprise Australia, that actually, you know, they had tours in the US and they got the key PR man from the US over to Australia to help them with their campaign. And they had similar, you know, pushing free enterprise materials into schools, etc. The other thing that happens is, for example, in Australia, union leaders were invited over to the US, first class fares, you know, pampered in the US, to a course at Harvard, where they're taught free market propaganda, and then they go back to Australia, and it undermines, you know, the whole union movement in Australia, because these people become union leaders and even, you know, leaders of the Labor Party in Australia. So
we have just been talking with Sharon Beeter. She is professor in the School of Social Sciences, Media and Communications at the University of Wollongong in New South Wales, Australia, and author of the new book, Free Market Missionaries, The Corporate Manipulation of Community Values.
And the interviewer was Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio. Next, we'll turn to John Marciano, who gives a free public class each year where students read and discuss important contemporary writings in history and politics. Last year, he taught Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. This year, his course is on Empire as a Way of Life by William Appleton Williams.
In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race.
Tonight we're talking about John Bellamy Foster's article that was in the Monthly Review. I will begin with a critical review of Foster's article, adding insights from some of his other articles in the Monthly Review magazine. These will be complemented by reflections from Noam Chomsky, America's leading dissenting public intellectual, journalist Stephen Kinzer, and the political economist Joseph Schumpeter. I will then conclude with a brief comment on the U.S.-Iraq War from Emmanuel Wallerstein, respected scholar on U.S. foreign relations, and link this to the recent congressional approval of the Iran Freedom Support Act. According to Foster, the rhetoric of empire knows few bounds, and the racist rhetoric of a century ago is being raised again. He writes that U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have led some to argue that there is a link between the new imperialism of the 21st century and the imperialism of the 19th and early 20th centuries. Some have even brought up Rudyard Kipling's famous poem about the white man's burden, a warning about the responsibilities of empire that was actually directed at the U.S. with its newfound imperial responsibilities in the Philippines. They suggest that Kipling's views remain just as relevant today as they were when the poem was written in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War. Foster reminds us that when the war with Spain ended, the U.S. would not recognize the new and independent Philippines with its popular nationalist movement led by Emilio Aguinaldo. The brutal U.S. imperial assault provoked a conflict with the Filipino forces, one part of an outright seizure of an overseas colonial empire. In response to a perceived need of U.S. businesses just recovering from an economic downturn for new global markets. Despite the savagery of this imperial aggression, however, President McKinley, future President Teddy Roosevelt, and many powerful figures supported it and welcomed Kipling's call for the U.S. to engage in savage wars beginning in the Philippines. U.S. forces killed at least 250,000 Filipinos, mostly civilians, a necessary response to counter the deep support for the Filipino resistance. As with the U.S.-Vietnam War some 60 years later, American troops engaged in genocidal assaults on the native population, including resettling the population in concentration camps, extensive torture, mass hangings and executions, and systematic raping of women and girls. The genocidal nature of U.S. operations was clear. For example, General Jacob Smith ordered his troops to kill and burn, to target everything over 10, and to turn one of the Philippine islands into a howling wilderness. Eyewitness reports from U.S. troops showed that wounded and captured Filipino combatants were summarily executed on the spot. For those knowledgeable with the documentary record in Vietnam, all this has a familiar and horrific ring. The war in the Philippines included the 1906 Moro Massacre against Muslim Filipinos, when some 900 civilians were slaughtered. Despite this outrageous violation of international law, President Teddy Roosevelt commended his good friend, General Wood. I congratulate you and the officers and men of your command upon the brilliant feat of arms wherein you and they so well upheld the honor of the American flag. When we know the actual record of U.S. imperialism around the world against people of color, we may finally confront the fact that U.S. behavior in the Philippines was not an aberration to otherwise noble intentions and policies. From General Sullivan's campaign against the Cayuga Nation in upstate New York in 1779, through Wounded Knee and Abu Ghraib, such behavior has been as American as apple pie. Foster tells us that Kipling's writings touched many whites because they seemed to evoke a transcendent and noble cause. The year his poem appeared, 1899, marked the beginning of the Philippine-U.S. War and the Anglo-Boer War in South Africa. These were classic imperialist wars, and they generated anti-imperialist movements and radical critiques in response. Given the horrendous U.S. aggression against the Filipinos, it is astounding that it is now being presented as a model for the kind of imperial role and rediscovered as the closest approximation in U.S. history to the problems the U.S. is encountering in Iraq. Foster asserts that U.S. imperialist apologists see Kipling's poem as an attempt to stiffen the spine of the U.S. ruling class of his day in preparation for what he called the Savage Wars of Peace. Rather than strengthening the U.S. empire today, however, Foster claims that this new phase of imperialism, rationalized in the West by veiled and not-so-veiled racism, will actually lead to the eventual decline of the American empire. He urges us not to fall prey to historical amnesia, that Kipling's White Man's Burden was a call for a joint exploitation of the globe by those whom the African-American scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois was later to call the white masters of the world in the face of the ebbing of British fortunes. Foster's critique of the U.S.-Filipino War is supported by the scholarship of Stephen Kinzer. In his book, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, Kinzer points out that the brutal assault in the Philippines set the stage for what happened in Vietnam 60 years later, exemplified by General Wheaton's order in the Philippines to destroy every town and village within 12 miles and their inhabitants killed after some of his men were ambushed by guerrilla forces. The nature of this war was graphically illustrated by the Philadelphia Ledger in 1901. Our men have been relentless, have killed to exterminate men, women, children, prisoners, and captives. Our soldiers have pumped salt water into men to make them talk, have taken prisoners people who held up their hands and peacefully surrendered, and an hour later stood them on a bridge and shot them down one by one. This happened 67 years before the massacres of Vietnamese at My Lai and Song Mi. According to Kinzer, Teddy Roosevelt defended such massacres and the honor of the troops he loved. Asking his close friend and ally, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, to make the case for U.S. troops in the Senate, Lodge admitted that there had been some cases of rough and cruel treatment applied to obtain information. Sound familiar? However, Americans who lived in sheltered homes far from the sounds and trials of war could not understand the challenge of bringing law to a semi-civilized people with all the tendencies and characteristics of Asiatics. Since these semi-civilized Asiatics did not massacre and torture U.S. troops, we must ask, who was civilized? It was in 1898, with the Cuban War of Independence, known here in the United States as the Spanish-American War, that the U.S. definitely embraced what Lodge called the large policy. Historians have given it various names: expansionism, imperialism, neocolonialism. This policy provoked opposition from an outspoken brand of idealists who denounced it as a mean-spirited betrayal of the American tradition. If we recall in this group Dunbar Ortiz's analysis of imperialism, we would reject the assertion that ideal traditions were being betrayed in the Philippines. The war there did not depart from the essential U.S. tradition of conquest that was in place at the founding. In an article on U.S. military bases and empire, Foster points out that empires throughout history have relied on foreign military bases to enforce their rule. And in this respect, at least, Pax Americana is no different than Pax Romana or Pax Britannica. After World War II, the United States took over Great Britain's role as the imperialist enforcer, with the most extensive system of military bases the world had ever seen. These were cut back until the Korean War, then increased during that conflict, and yet again during the U.S.-Vietnam War. It was only after Vietnam that the total number of bases began to fall once again. Despite this drop, however, the U.S., like all empires, has been extremely reluctant to relinquish any base once established. Although the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s created a strong expectation that there would be a rapid cutback in U.S. bases and the U.S. military establishment, the so-called peace dividend, it did not happen. 9/11 and the war on terrorism brought a rapid increase in the number and geographic spread of U.S. bases. For example, Foster emphasizes the critical role of the major U.S. naval base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, established when a joint British-U.S. effort removed all of the residents from that island in the 1960s to make way for the base, and then that removal was kept secret for decades. These U.S. bases and military forces and U.S. willingness to use them abroad are critical to maintaining U.S. hegemony around the world because, in Foster's words, it would be impossible to keep many of the more dependent economic territories from breaking away. U.S. global, political, economic, and financial power thus requires the periodic exercise of military power, the iron fist behind the velvet glove. The U.S., therefore, is the main enforcer of the imperialist rules of the game. An absolute key point, since the U.S. and all empires ultimately rest on a foundation of violence. In an article about U.S. imperial ambitions in Iraq, Foster writes about the recent historical roots of U.S. imperialism, what he calls a third phase that emerged after World War II. During the war, the United States developed a plan for gaining control of what it considered to be the strategic centers of the world economy, an ambition that was then only limited by the extent of the Soviets. Noam Chomsky has discussed the formation of this strategy, pointing out that the fundamental premises for American foreign policy after the war were developed in the planning documents produced during that conflict by the State Department planners and the Council on Foreign Relations. Since these planners knew that the war was going to end with the U.S. in a position of enormous global dominance, they worked on grand area planning, the area that was strategically necessary for world control. The grand area was that area of the world that was open to domination by the U.S. These elite planners worked from the premise that the U.S. economy had to prosper without internal changes, a crucial point which comes through in all the discussions in this period, without any redistribution of income or power or modification of structures. Chomsky asserts that they determine that the minimum area strategically necessary for world control included the entire Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, which they were in the process of dismantling, and the Far East, essentially a large part of the world. Foster urges us to understand this worldwide domination. That is, we must see that its wars, the U.S. wars of imperialist expansion, however unjustified, always demand some kind of justification. Often this has been accomplished through the doctrine of defensive war. He cites political economist Joseph Schumpeter's 1919 essay, The Sociology of Imperialisms, to show the obvious parallels between Rome during its years of greatest expansion and recent U.S. expansion. In Schumpeter's words, there was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were of Rome's allies. If Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, and the whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies. That sound familiar? Foster writes that the pretense about so-called defensive wars did not die with the Roman Empire. It is now the rationale for the expansion of American imperialism in the 20th century and the 21st century. The targeted enemies of the U.S. at present are located in the Third World, where the possibilities for outright expansion of U.S. imperialism are greatest. In Foster's article, Imperial America and War, he agrees with Soviet revolutionary leader Lenin. Imperialism was inherent in capitalism from the beginning. Many of the features of contemporary imperialism, such as the development of the Western market, the extraction of surplus, and the securing of raw materials to bring back to the mother country, have been the basis of capitalism for more than 500 years. Imperialism, in the widest sense, had its sources in the accumulation dynamics of this system, especially in what writer Pierre Jaly called the pillage of the Third World. Our final article from Foster, to add to his original piece, called A Warning to Africa, concludes by urging us to reject the idea that this latest U.S. imperial thrust is the work of a small cabal of neoconservatives, because, as he argues, the reality is one of broad concurrence within the U.S. power structure on the necessity of expanding the U.S. empire. The present White House unilateral policy of building an empire on American power alone has changed things in form only, by stripping away the empire's hidden character and reducing its overall force by relying less on vassal states. But such an aggressive posture is not outside the historic range of U.S. policy that has been the hallmark of both Democratic and Republican administrations. We are dealing with a bipartisan foreign policy, an imperial strategy that is less a product of policies generated in Washington by this or that wing of the ruling class than an inevitable result of the power position that U.S. capitalism finds itself. In Overthrow, Kinzer also points out that over the past century, the U.S. repeatedly used its military power and that of its clandestine services to overthrow governments that refused to protect American interests. We need to be more precise about what this American or national interest is, however, given that it actually represents and hides the particular class interests of the dominant elite rather than the truly democratic interest of the nation as a whole. Kinzer claims the U.S. cloaked its intervention in the rhetoric of national security and liberation. In most cases, however, it acted mainly for economic reasons, specifically to establish, promote, and defend the right of Americans to do business around the world without interference. He believes that the influence of economic power over U.S. foreign policy has grown tremendously since the days when ambitious planters in Hawaii realized that by bringing the islands into the United States, they would be able to send their sugar to markets on the mainland without paying import duties. Kinzer is too general in his political economy analysis, however. It is not economic power in the abstract that is the influencing factor, but the concrete and relentless capitalist search for profit that is the key issue here. Kinzer writes that these corporate businessmen might not have been able to do so if they and the president who cooperated with them had candidly presented their cases to the American people. There must be massive lying, therefore, at the top of the political system, in addition to hegemonic brainwashing in schools and media to get citizens to accept the sordid realities of our imperial foreign policy. Kinzer claims the real development of U.S. imperialism began in the late 19th century, led by a handful of visionary writers and intellectuals. We should ask, however, why these ideas took hold in this particular historical period rather than another, and what are the relationships between dominant ideas, class relations, wealth, and powerful institutions? The domination of some ideas over others does not explain itself. Therefore, we have to go to the roots, to the political and economic conditions, to explain why some ideas become dominant in any particular historical epoch. In 1893, the historian Frederick Jackson Turner, a leading U.S. intellectual, published a provocative essay on expansion. He concluded that there was no longer a frontier in the U.S., and that this left the country with a stark choice. It could either declare itself satisfied with its present size, something it had never done before, or seek territories beyond North America. We now know what choice Turner and powerful corporate and political officials made. For nearly three centuries, he stated, the dominant fact in American life has been expansion. The demands for a vigorous foreign policy are indications that the movement will continue. According to Kinzer, one man took these demands and turned them into action, Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan, director of the Naval War College. He urged that the U.S. not only speedily build a canal across Central America, but also establish bases in the Caribbean, the Pacific, and wherever else it wished to trade. Mahan proclaimed, Americans must now begin to look outward. The growing production of the country demands it. This growing productive base was the real foundation that shaped the fundamental ideological changes. As Kinzer points out, however, the great productive explosion and new wealth in the U.S. economy in the last quarter of the 19th century enriched only a few thousand captains of industry. Conditions for most ordinary people were steadily deteriorating. This growing class divide and increasingly class conflict it created, therefore, caused many business and policy leaders to quickly conclude that the only way the American economy could expand quickly enough to deal with these threats was to find new markets abroad. Kinzer does not confront this historical phenomenon as directly as John Bellamy Foster, who argues that the fundamental and underlying reasons for the rise of U.S. imperialism are to be found in the underlying dynamics of an increasingly productive capitalist system that must expand or die. In Kinzer's narrative, the first wave of American regime operations, which lasted from 1893 to 1911, revolved around the search for resources, markets, and commercial opportunities. Even though Roosevelt, Lodge, and Mahan were moved by what they considered to be the transcendent imperatives of history, these transcendent imperatives, however, would have not garnered the ruling class support had they not produced profit for the elite and its corporations. The transcendent missionary instinct that was expressed by Roosevelt and Lodge was already deeply ingrained in the American psyche. From John Winthrop's proclaimed dream of a city upon the hill in the 17th century to which the world would look for inspiration, Americans have considered themselves a special people. The Americans referred to here, however, are not first Americans, but white English settlers of means. By the end of the 19th century, many U.S. leaders came to believe they had a duty to civilize needy savages and rescue exploited masses from oppression. This duty, however, evidently did not extend to ending the exploitation of blacks, first Americans, Latinos, and working people here at home. This American concern was often mixed with racism, an essential ingredient of a U.S. paternalism that has always been laced with white supremacy. Many Americans considered Latin Americans and the Pacific Islanders to be colored natives in need of guidance from whites. In a nation whose black population was systematically repressed and where racial prejudice was widespread, this view helped many accept the need for the U.S. to dominate foreign countries. While the rhetoric of imperialism would be heavily tinged with racism, Kinzer tells us that anti-imperialists also used racist arguments. Many did not want the U.S. to seize foreign territories because doing so would increase the number of non-white people within its borders. It is surprising that Kinzer should find this fact interesting, given that both imperialists and anti-imperialists of that era started from the same premise of white supremacy when it came to people of color around the world and within the United States. For Kinzer, the shattering events of 1898 established the U.S. as a world power, and it began to flex its newfound policy muscle. The first region targeted was the Caribbean Basin, and a key issue was the building of an inter-ocean canal and control of the region. The inevitable result of our building the canal, Secretary of War Elihu Root asserted in 1906, must be to require us to police the surrounding premises. As with the rest of the world, the last two decades of the 19th century brought economic crises to the U.S. as it suffered through depressions or financial panics in the mid-1870s, the mid-1880s, and the early 1890s. Many leaders believed that overseas expansion was the answer to this destructive cycle. By supporting what was termed the open-door policy, the U.S. managed to export many of its social problems. The key to social problems was in the nature of the capitalist system at home, however, the root cause of imperialism abroad. Exploitation and racism began here at home, not in the Philippines or Cuba. Controlling markets abroad put Americans to work, but it distorted the economies of poor countries in ways that greatly increased their poverty, an inevitable result of capitalist exploitation simply not grasped by liberal critics of U.S. foreign policy such as Kinzer. It is not an accidental byproduct of an otherwise benevolent foreign policy and therefore can't be changed by simply tinkering with the margins of our political and economic system. Kinzer tells us correctly that American corporations accumulated vast sugar and fruit plantations in the Pacific, Central America, and the Caribbean, and they forced countless small farmers off their land. This process was deepened as other American corporations flooded these countries with manufactured goods and prevented the development of local industry. This process is a necessary result of a U.S. economic imperialism that is lamented by liberal critics of our foreign policy, but such lamentations cannot do justice to the actual historical exploitation of the Third World. The first American regime change operations had a great impact on the nation and the world, according to Kinzer. The scandal over torture and murder in the Philippines, he suggests, might have led Americans to rethink their country's worldwide ambitions, but it did not. Instead, they came to accept the idea that their soldiers might have to commit atrocities in order to subdue insurgents and win wars. Again, it sounds familiar. Actually, citizens were led to accept this idea by ruling elites and their educational, media, and political apologists, just as today. Although there were loud protests over U.S. abuses in the Philippines, in the end, those protests faded away, just like Abu Ghraib. They were drowned out by voices which insisted that any abuses must have been aberrations and that to dwell on them would show weakness and a lack of patriotism. When it comes to slaughtering people of color around the world, therefore, nothing changes. I would like to close my comments tonight by taking Foster's anti-imperialist analysis to the present moment and the U.S.-Iraq war.